This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by our new sponsor, FRPGames.com, an online game store with regular sales between 20% and 90% off. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
VorpalNetwork.com.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 131. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're going to convince a king, dodge the traps, and find a secret lair with advice about skill challenges. And our guest for this episode is Dave Chalker from Critical Hits. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a long time in the making getting you on for an advice episode. You've been on many times in the past, but never to talk some advice. So it's good to have you on in that.
Well, you know, I thought it was having to dispense all my wisdom to the masses, you know.
Yeah, because you don't get very many opportunities to do that as it is.
My blog and Twitter and everything else.
It's not like you have a well-known public forum for dispensing your wisdom.
No.
But before we get too far into what you're doing over at Critical Hits, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the world of D&D. In terms of news, seems fairly light, other than the new book Plane Above comes out this month. And I think you had a few things that you could mention, because you recently went to PAX East, and you mentioned that there were some things going on over there.
Yep. So PAX East, for those who don't know, is the Penny Arcade Expo, run by the Penny Arcade guys. They sort of spun off from their West Coast Seattle show to have one in Boston, in addition to their one on the West Coast. And this was the first one. And Wizards of the Coast actually had a pretty big presence there. They had a couple rooms, a big booth, like their banners and advertising were everywhere. They were running the Dark Sun preview that they had also done at D&D XP, that I've now played through twice, and it's a pretty cool little adventure. And there was also D&D Encounters that they were showing off. They ran, I think, the first two of them there, and I finally got to play in the first one. And they also had this thing called the DM Challenge.
What was the DM Challenge?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I wasn't waiting for that at all. So Underdark came out in the past couple of months, and so they said, hey, DMs, plan an adventure using stuff from Underdark for six-level characters that they provided, and they provided to the DMs beforehand. And, you know, they provided some other parameters, like it's 5 hours and, you know, how many encounters it should have. And it ended up being about 10 of us all together entering. And to my surprise, even though it was opposite one of the big concerts, it was a completely packed room. Every DM had a full table of six. And I think there were even people who got turned away because there weren't enough DMs. Wow. We all ran our adventure. And afterwards, the players of the adventure scored how well we did in a couple different metrics. And I won.
So the best DM in the entire convention at PAX East is with us today in this episode. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
I think that's some pretty high pedigree.
Well, I would say so, too. I mean, the contest.
No, really. Don't pat anyone back.
Yeah. I'm really good at that, actually. You know, it's hard to say because it's not like every group of players got to play every adventure and then compare them or anything. And I had a really, really great group. A lot of them already knew each other, so they immediately worked well. And they all had a good time, and they were really into the system and all that. So that really worked in my favor, too. You know, it's not to say that like the other DMs were bad or the other groups were bad. I'm just saying, it's not an objective measure, but I'll take it.
Well, that sounds great. I congratulate you on that. And that hopefully brings some extra pedigree to this episode, because our topics are going to be relatively DM-focused, although we are going to take the perspective of looking at the player side of today's topic as well. In terms of show news or network news, I did want to mention that people can head over to the Vorpal Network forums where we have some free monsters up. There's a thread where people are posting their own custom-built monsters. So you can come by and check those out or post your own monsters for other people to look at. I've got several of my own there, and I hope to see some more activity in that one because that's one of my favorite threads. And then also, I'm calling this month the skill challenge month because my goal in April is to look very in-depth at skill challenges starting with this episode. I was recently surprised to find out that there was still a lot of questions on this topic, but I was inundated with a whole bunch of them all at once within a couple of days, so I decided, okay, that's it. I'm going to really focus on this for a little while. Put out a couple of episodes talking about it, gather up some of the best advice or examples or wisdom on the topic, and that way whenever people have questions about it, I can always just send them back to these two episodes and hope that that'll help a lot of people sort of understand and get their heads around the concept of the skill challenge and make them work for them. So part one of that is bringing Dave here in for this advice episode where we're going to build a skill challenge and we're going to talk about how to be a good player in a skill challenge. And then my current plan is to release another episode towards the end of the month that will include segments from a variety of different contributors giving examples and advice and just more and more information about how to run a skill challenge successfully. So I hope people enjoy that. And I look forward to putting it together. I think it should help some people out. But that's what's going on the network. That's what's going on with D&D. Now it's time to find out what's going on over at Critical Hits. It's been a while since we've talked about your site.
Oh, well, it's one of my favorite topics. I'm really going to come off arrogant in this episode, aren't I?
I'm going to try.
Okay, sounds good. Working towards the same thing.
So, I know you've gone through some changes, I think, in Critical Hit since we last got an update.
Some
new writers and...
Those are the big ones. So at the beginning of the year, we absorbed Chatty DM, who has also been a guest on your fine show several times.
Yes.
I was looking for more writers to contribute, and he was kind of tired of doing all the technical stuff. We actually already were hosted on the same server, and so it wasn't a huge technical thing to take all of his posts, and I sort of had to do some redesign, nitty-gritty stuff of the website to give him his own section, but it lets him concentrate on what he does best, which is being chatty. And I've taken more of an editorial role. And then that kind of snowballed into getting a bunch more writers, mm-hmm. Some of whom said, hey, if, you know, Phil's joining up, that sounds like fun. And some others, you know, I just sort of put out the call and see who responded and been extremely happy. I've had Scott Wallace, who used to do stuff for Dungeon Mastering, who writes these great flavorful pieces every week. And Veneer, who does role-playing stuff for Stupid Ranger, but I've gotten him to do some more general nerd video game stuff for me. Cool. And our newest kind of big name, Chris Sims, who was formerly with Wizards of the Coast, one of their writer, editor, R&D people.
Mm-hmm. So how'd you manage to snag Chris Sims?
It's Phil's fault.
Phil is the chatty DM, there was people not keeping score.
Yes, the chatty DM. he was chatty. He had been talking to Chris, and they had been talking about a couple projects even when Chris was with Wizards, mm-hmm. and had been in email contact and kind of put the two of us in touch. And Chris was looking to do some blogging himself since he was laid off from Wizards back in December. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, I've got this platform that's already got a bunch of readers. You know, we'll pretty much give you whatever you want. What do you think? And it seems to be going really well so far.
Good. And he seems, yeah, he seems to have acclimated to the format fairly well. And I noticed that somebody's even got him involved in the social networking sphere over on Twitter.
Yep. He's trying to branch out and all that. He wanted to learn more about blogging, which is, you know, one of the few things that I could probably teach him about. And he's got tons and tons of great knowledge about freelance writing, about submitting to D&D Insider, about even just being a DM. You know, he's got character and DM advice, and loves to talk about it. He's opened up his own mailbag column, just asking, like, whatever questions you have about those fields, just send him his way. And it's been working out really well so far.
Cool. All right. Well, anything else going on over at Critical Hits or in your world that you'd like to talk about?
Just one other thing. We will be launching probably this week our first episode of the Dungeon Master Guys podcast, which will just be some DM advice from myself and Chatty DM and Newbie DM and whoever else that we can rope in on an episode-by-episode basis, maybe even yourself at one point, I hope.
I would love to.
Awesome. And, yeah, just targeted DM advice, shorter show, like around half an hour. Just a couple different segments from us, and looking forward to it. Our first episode is done. It just needs to get put up.
Very cool. I look forward to hearing it.
And
will that be coming out on the Critical Hits podcast feed, the normal podcast feed?
It'll have its own feed, but you'll still be able to find it through Critical Hits.
Okay, cool. So now I've got another feed to subscribe to.
Yeah.
More and more of these bloggers keep working their way over into MySpace in the podcasting sphere. It's good to see the community grow.
Yeah. It's a pretty good problem to have, I would say.
Yeah. I'm going to take some credit for it since, you know, a lot of the blogging world seems to have gotten their start podcasting on this show.
Yep, you're a pioneer, sir.
I do what I can. Well, it's been great to have everybody be able to have all these guests on the show in the last, year and a half or so, too. So, all right.
And you got people used to listening to our voice.
Yeah, well, I do what I can. I try to help out. But now it's time to get ready to build our skill challenge. But before that, I need to talk about our brand new Vorpal Network sponsor, FRP Games. They have some really, really good deals on games. Like I mentioned at the top of the show, sometimes they have deals up to 90% off. My pick for this episode is not one of those big sale items, but it is an exciting item. It is coming out this month. It is Plane Above from Wizards of the Coast, available for, in this case, $6 off, nothing to sneeze at, from FRP Games. This book is all about sort of making the astral plane a viable campaign setting in the same way Plane Below tried to give some detail on the elemental chaos. Personally, I'm a big fan of the planes, and this book is pretty high on my to-get list, and you can find it and a ton more. I was looking at a bunch of miniatures the other day at 40% off. You can get it from frpgames.com.
FRP Games is an online retailer specializing in all aspects of your tabletop gaming needs. Whether it's RPGs, dice, war games, or computer games, FRP Games has a wide selection of products. They offer overstock items where you can pick up all kinds of gaming gear ranging from 30% off all the way up to 90% off the retail price. Through our website, you'll be directed to their weekly new products, eBay auctions, or you can even buy your special gaming someone a gift certificate. FRP Games is an authorized Wizards of the Coast retailer and for 10 years has been committed to providing each customer with the highest standard of customer service possible. Visit our website for instant access to FRP Games inventory of thousands of unique gaming items.
All right, Dave, it is now time to build a skill challenge. Now, we sort of chit-chatted a little bit ahead of time about what sort of skill challenge we want to run. There's a multitude of different things you can do with a skill challenge, and that's something I hope gets discussed at length in this in the skill challenge month, this couple of episodes that I have planned. But in our case, we're going to look at a skill challenge based on the task of researching.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've recently run a skill challenge based on this concept, and you said that you've recently run a skill challenge based on this idea. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the one that you ran, and then I'll talk about the one that I ran, and then we can sort of build a new one from scratch a little bit.
Sounds good. So my setup's a bit weird. My players were back in time because they had a time machine, and they went to a lost library of Narath that had the book that they needed to find out more about their nemesis, the Chain God. And so they needed to find in this gigantic library one book that they were looking for. And the additional complication was that everything was written in ancient Narathi script, which none of them read, and they had some time constraints, and they couldn't just sit there and cast rituals to try to decipher which one. So the skill challenge was both kind of, can they find it, and can they decipher it, and where should they go in this library?
Okay, cool. My skill challenge was, the idea is the players are trying to repair a airship. They found one, you know, in the ocean, but it doesn't fly anymore. And they need to, they're looking for ancient plans on this airship so they can figure out what's wrong with it so they can try to fix it. And they've made it into this sort of pocket dimension laboratory of this wizard. And what I enjoyed about this skill challenge was that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't one of those skill challenges where you sit down, you run the skill challenge, and then you're done and you move on to the next encounter. The skill challenge happened throughout a dungeon crawl. So they first walk into the laboratory. They see carvings of depicting images on, you know, as they come down to the stairway, and they have to do a history check or whatever to decipher what's going on in those carvings, and that's one success. As they get a little bit of information about how these carvings are showing pictures of how this person built an airship, and then later on they find these sketches, and then they find a model, and they've managed to talk to some golems that were alive helping build it way back in the day, and on and on and on. And so there's encounters scattered all throughout it, and all along the way as they go through this dungeon crawl, they're finding little bits and pieces that they need to eventually help them fix their airship.
Sounds very cool. So, it's an adventure structure to run a skill challenge, too.
Yeah, and it was fun. I know I had a good time with it, and I got the impression that my players did as well. Now, we're going to build a different skill challenge based on the idea of research. Do you have any ideas of – let's start with, what are we researching? What are our characters going to research?
Well, it's always good when you can bring in more skills, I think. Mm-hmm. And the setup for the scenario can suggest, you know, what skills beyond just a select few could possibly be used.
Absolutely. You have an idea?
Go ahead. Nope, go ahead.
I was going to say, what if they are researching the location of an item? They're in a city, and they're trying to find, you know, the mystical orb of fire, but they don't know where it is. And so this city is supposed to hold clues to where the mystical orb of fire is. Does that sound like something we can start to build from?
Yep, that sounds good.
So what can we do to make that scenario, I think, maybe a little bit more interesting, other than let's find some clues about where the orb of fire is? What complications can we throw into that?
Yeah, complications are important, and also the sense that the narrative is going forward with every skill check, I think, is important.
Yeah.
So you said it's in a city, which means that social skills can actually come into play.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we can give some more character to this library, like it's run by an order of monks of a certain religion, and maybe they've taken a vow of silence, and they can't just
And maybe they have some other weird religious things that they can't just show them where the book is.
And don't mind me, I'm typing some of this as we go so I can actually format it all up and put it up on the site when we're done. And we could also add the condition or the complication that maybe they're not the only people looking for the Orbifier.
Yep, exactly what I was thinking too.
Maybe there's another group, and so now they not only have to find it, but they have to find it while dodging these guys. And there's a risk of attack or whatever if the two groups bump into each other.
And it also kind of builds in a timer too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the task. What are our steps then? Like how complicated of a skill challenge do we want this to be? It sounds like we're building something that could be fairly long and drawn out, but it could also be more of a medium-sized skill challenge, it seems.
Yeah, medium sounds about right to me. It's not quite enough to take up kind of a whole game session in and of itself, and you'd probably have some kind of an encounter at least at the end. But at the same time, it's not, you know, straightforward.
Okay. So how many steps would you say are required in a skill challenge of this size? Are you thinking 6 successes? Are you thinking 8 successes?
I think around 8 sounds right. You want to at least go through the members of your party at least once and kind of mix it up a bit too.
Okay. So what sort of skills do we see as being useful in here? I mean, obviously, I think we could do things like a streetwise.
Yep, streetwise would work. Both two kind of go-to skill challenge skills, Arcana and History, because both of them you'd be accustomed to being in libraries and knowing how they're organized before the Dewey Decimal System is invented.
Yeah. Streetwise, in order to find out from people on the street what's going on, in History, in order to figure out, you know, where things are in the library itself, is your idea?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Arcana for sort of the same idea, to kind of figure out the lay of the library.
Okay. And one of the ways I often go with situations like that more than Arcana is that I often go with perception. Because it's a matter of spotting, you know, oh, there is a system here, or, you know, those kinds of things seem to be a matter of being perceptive.
Right. Yeah, that may even be good for later on, too, when you think you're getting close, to actually be able to narrow it down enough.
Okay. So what if one of the religious traditions of the monastic order that runs this library is that they, in order to protect themselves and their secrets, they keep the library's location a secret.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the streetwise could come into play. You need to butter people up and talk to people and listen to the rumors and what have you in order to figure out where the library is.
Yep, and even just having a secret library of forbidden knowledge is pretty appealing by itself.
Right. And of course, then the history arcana, history will give, and arcana will give us what?
You give us just figuring out, hey, this is, you know, I've been in libraries before. I know how to get at least a rough idea of how things are organized and where roughly a book like I'm looking for might be with other books.
So using the sort of the library organization system in order to find where to look.
Yep. I mean, if you're a barbarian, you know, you probably don't have those skills and you probably have never been in a library and so would have no idea.
Sure, that makes
sense.
But
if you're like a bookish wizard or something.
And I think a good backup to that is if you fail at the history or arcana to find your way around the library, then you could have a backup of diplomacy to ask somebody and get them to tell you where to go.
Right, or intimidate. So that's your role for the barbarian. If all else fails, threaten the monks.
So that gets us a little closer, and then maybe we go to perception in order to actually find it?
Mm-hmm.
Find it on the shelves? And then I think we have a good area where we can throw in some additional complications, because I think that's a good spot for maybe our competition to show up.
Yes, I agree. Just when you think it's within the grasp.
So do we have the competition maybe – I see two ways of going with this. The competition actually gets to the book first, or you get to the book first and now you need to get out before the competition finds out that you were there.
Yeah, they sort of present themselves differently. I'd be tempted to say it could branch either way, depending on how many failures you have up until that point.
Okay.
If you have no failures going into it, you've gotten there the fastest, and you get the book just as they're coming in.
And then if you have one or two failures, they got there first?
Yep. And so then it kind of branches into two different kinds for their section.
Skill challenges there, yeah. So on one hand, you have the they got – or we got there first. And so then you can do things like have an athletics check in order to, you know, lift the grate on the nearby floodgate entrance or sewer entrance or whatever in order to try to get down there quickly before they come around the corner.
Right. And stealth would also be another good one.
Yeah.
Although I'm tempted to think that if my party were to get in that scenario, they'd just be, oh, we can take these guys, let's fight them, and then escape with the book unhindered. So let's figure out some contingency for that, too.
Although you could also try to at least, I mean, not stop them from doing that, but you could certainly dissuade them from doing so by having one of the monks, you know, sort of, maybe not verbally, obviously, because we talked about them having a vow of silence or something, but presenting them with some rules of the library, you know, and that if they do get in a fight, there's a risk of damage. If there's a risk of damage, then they're not allowed to take anything from the library.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And it could even be magically enforced somehow, like the book, you know, they would escape with the book and then would have no writing and anything like that.
Yeah. That'd be good. Okay, so in that case, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 successes, and they've gotten away with the book. Is that the end of the skill challenge at that point for them? Maybe we reduce the number of steps needed.
That seems pretty reasonable. If you wanted to have some... it would require kind of multiple steps to either escape from the library or to catch up to them. Maybe they have something with them that presents additional complications either way that they didn't expect.
I mean, you could always do, it just occurred to me, you could do a dungeoneering check in order to find your way through the sewers without getting lost.
Right.
And then if you fail at that, you know, maybe the competition is there and waiting for you when you come out.
Right.
So what if they get then there you can first? What if the competition gets there first?
If the competition gets there first, they say, ha ha, we have the book and, you know, we're going to get away with it. And so then maybe it's an actual chase, you know, like they sort of switch positions in that the rival group is trying to sneak around and the players are making perception checks. Or they're running away and there's an athletics check. You could even break it up. Like if you knew if the party was familiar with the rivals they were going against, then you could say, well, this one member of the rival party might have it and this other one might have it. And they have two different, you know, one's a rogue and one's a fighter, and so they'll be trying to get away with it in different ways, but you don't necessarily know which one has it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to split the party.
Yeah. So they the competition splits up, and you don't know which one of them or which group the book went with. So you've got to split the party to chase them, and then you could even maybe include a streetwise to see what you know about this gang or this group or whatever, and then figure out where they might be going with it.
Yep, and insight would be another good one to use.
Yeah, in fact, I oftentimes will bundle insight with perception as well. You know, on one hand, you're looking for them. On the other hand, it's also helpful if you can get into their psychology a little bit, because it maybe makes it easier as a secondary check. You know, your insight might give you a bonus to your perception because you have an idea of where they might be going. You know, in the same way, I like the idea of using endurance in chase scenes in the same way that athletics is used. You know, sometimes it's not about how fast you run, it's about how long you can run.
Exactly. And endurance is kind of underused anyway.
I agree. I try to come up with ways to use endurance when I can, because I think it's much more relevant than it gets credit for.
Yep. I agree with that.
Okay, so in this case, they've used perception to find the competition before they get out of the library. Then they've chased them down the streets using athletics and endurance. And then they've used streetwise to try to figure out where they might be going to hide the book. Well, let's say they've figured that out. What's the end result of this then? I assume at that point we've got about the same number of checks on both branches.
Yeah, well, probably as always, it leads to a fight of some kind.
Okay, so in the end, it leads to a fight. How does that fight differ depending on where they go?
Yeah, so if we assume for a minute that they've, let's say the bad guys have gotten away with the book, the PCs have kind of failed to head them off at a lot of passes. You know, you don't want it to necessarily be adventure or campaign stopper right there.
Right.
You could either, well, the easiest thing to do, I think, would be they are able to still track them down and where they went to their hideout, but their hideout is kind of, you know, it's crawling with extra muscle and traps and everything else. And so it becomes a much harder fight than just taking them down on the streets.
Yep. Okay, and so that's the failure condition. The success condition is that you stop them on the streets before they get to their hideout, and you can fight them in the streets on an equal footing.
Yeah, or even you get a chance to kind of ambush them. And another good trick there is to just say that, like, if the good guys get the chance to ambush, then the bad guys have to set up first, and the good guys can sort of set themselves up wherever they want on the battle map.
Okay.
Because they're lying there waiting, and so they have the more advantageous positions.
Okay, so yeah, they give the party a chance to set up.
Yep. And, you know, failure, it's kind of the reverse. The bad guys have the chance to...
Yep.
Prepare themselves and get whatever extra preparations.
Okay, good. And so let's go back to the other scenario where the party got to the book first and they're running through the sewers with it.
Mm-hmm.
How does that one play out then? What's the success and failure conditions of that?
I'd be tempted to say on success, they kind of get away scot-free. You know, if they've done pretty much everything perfectly up to that point, so you give them the XP for everything, the bad guys and all, anyway, and say you've gotten the book, you know, you have a group of people who aren't too happy with you, and that may lead to something further down to get away. You fail, it's like you were suggesting earlier, where, you know, they manage to eventually find their way out of the sewer, but the bad guys are waiting for them, and so the PCs get ambushed.
Right, and you maybe don't have quite the difficult combat of you're in their hideout, you know, where they've got all the extra muscle and the traps and what have you, but they've at least had a chance to lay in wait, and they've had a chance to set up and prepare to ambush you, and they get the surprise round and what have you. Good.
Yep.
So I think we've built a decent little skill challenge, and we've challenged the party to find the way to get to the Orb of Fire within this place. And I think there's a lot of different ways we could have gone with that, too. I like the place we went. I also considered at one point maybe there's not a library, but there's you know, the Orb of Fire was crafted here 1,000 years ago, and there's clues throughout the city, sort of a la, you know, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code and that kind of, and Angels and Demons, where they have to hunt all over the city and find clues and that kind of stuff. And I think that could have brought in a different element to it as well. So I guess there's a lot of different ways you can take this one concept of doing research and turn it into a lot of a lot of unique things.
And I can think of a couple other ones that have been published before that are different ways to tackle it too. Like there's one in Revenge of the Giants that's a research ancient knowledge skill challenge, and there's at least one dungeon adventure that's kind of in a weird haunted library that also throws some extra complications.
Sure. And I guess I have on here that we should consider that what difficulties to make these skill checks. I mean, a lot of that is pretty straightforward and based and right down in the rules. If they're in this level and you're earning a skill challenge, these should be the DCs. I tend to stick to those pretty straightforward myself. Do you often do any adjustments to the DCs?
I almost always play with them.
In what way? I mean, how do you change them and for what reasons?
Well, first of all, I think the big thing for everybody is that it's an easy way to reward good ideas. So if somebody says, I'm doing this thing and you haven't thought of it, but it makes total sense, you know, I tend to make that an easier difficulty. And if it's something that's a little bit more outlandish, you know, bump it up to the harder difficulties.
Sure.
But I also find that, you know, maybe it's just my players, but, you know, they're relatively min-maxed even as far as skills go. And so a lot of the DCs aren't necessarily challenging. And so if it's something that I need to present some kind of challenge to, I'll bump them up depending on, you know, the party and the task and all that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I find skills a lot of times in my group tend to be more of a second thought a lot of times, depending on the character. But for a lot of my players, it's more of a second thought, and so they're not necessarily quite as min-maxed.
Right.
And so I don't feel like I need to adjust them too much. Now, obviously, within the skill challenge chart of DCs, you have a range of easy, normal, and hard. And so you can sort of adjust from that. You know, I might, for example, looking at the list of things we have, I might make the history or arcana check. Maybe I would say the arcana check is in the hard DC range, but the history check is more of a standard DC range because it seems to make a little more sense in the realm of what we're talking about. You know?
Yep, that makes sense.
Give a little bit of a reward to the history guy for taking that skill when the arcana is sometimes a little more useful, you know?
Yep.
But at the same time, you also want to consider things like, okay, with our streetwise check to find the library to begin with, we don't want to make that too hard. Cause that can be a bit of a showstopper, you know, if they fail that streetwise and they don't find the library, we've got to find a way for them to find the library anyway.
Yeah. I would be tempted to say that it's not a matter of, you know, do you find the library or not? It's just a matter of how long does it take you to find the library? Yeah. Which is then factored in later on to our branch points.
Absolutely.
Yep.
I think that's good. But at the same time, you know, how secretive of a library is this? You know, doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, the Illuminati here. It could be kind of a secret, but a well-known secret, you know?
Right.
And I mean, everything else is all. I don't know. I don't see anything here that necessarily says that it needs to be anything other than standard. You know, lifting a grate is fairly standard DC. The stealth doesn't even necessarily need a DC. It can be, you know, an opposed check. So yeah, I'm just looking through here. It seems like a lot of this can be fairly standard DCs, and you know, play with it obviously a little bit depending on what you need to do in your specific running of the skill challenge to add it, make it a little bit more dynamic, right? You know, if in your description of the scenario there you're chasing the competition down the street and they manage to duck through a crowded alleyway, then, you know, maybe that athletics check is a little bit more difficult for the party because now they're having to dodge through a crowd as well.
Yep. I find that a lot where I'll add embellishments just sort of in the heat of running and narrating and the players asking questions, and then they'll latch onto that embellishment and it suddenly becomes a bigger deal, which gives them further ideas, and then you sort of need to adjust from there.
Absolutely. And I think that gets into our last little topic for this build as well, in just sort of not advice on running skill challenges in general, but on this one specifically. What advice could we have on running when, you know, if we were actually to set this up in a game? What should people maybe look out for? I mean, I think we talked about something, you know, don't make the streetwise a deal ender, right? It's not a matter of whether or not they find it. It's a matter of how quickly they find the library, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And overall, don't make it so that any of them, you know, stop the flow of the action. Just it's just how long it takes them in comparison to this other group. And I think a good thing to keep in mind while running it would be just have sort of a mental timeline of what's going on with this other group. You know, what are they doing at the same time? How successful are they? And that can sort of give you an idea of how to pace things and, you know, what would make sense, you know, maybe even some hints, like the party spies that, you know, just out of the corner of their eye that one of their party members is spying on them. So they get a hint that there's someone else here, and maybe that gives them clues into how much longer they have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an area where we didn't go into much in our build, is that secondary skills can play a pretty interesting role in the whole thing as well. You know, I might give an extra bonus to the perception check of finding the book if they left somebody back by the door who's waiting for the other group to come in. You know, if they happen to know that they have competition, so you got some warning that you need to hurry, and I might kind of reward that with a plus two on a perception check or whatever.
Yeah, totally. And it gives everyone in the party, even if they're not the skill type, something to do if they feel like, oh, you know, because I stayed to guard the door, or, you know, I have my hand on my sword, it's this extra little bonus for role-playing what they would do in that scenario.
Yeah, and I think we did
that. It helps them.
And towards that same goal, I think we did a nice job of looking at a range of different skills. I mean, we have the social skills here with the diplomacy and the streetwise, but we've also got the muscle skills, so to speak, you know, with the athletics and the endurance, and but we didn't ignore the knowledges like the history and dungeoneering and that kind of thing. So it seems to me that however you decided to go with your skills as a character, you've got a pretty good chance of contributing something in the skill challenge.
Yep.
All right. Well, I'm going to format that up, include it in the show notes. Anything else you want to say about this before we head off to our next little segment?
No, I kind of want to steal your find the plans to the airship skill challenge adventure thing for my own campaign. But other than that...
Well, I'm done running it now, so I'd be happy actually to publish my notes for it on the forums, and you could just head over there and get it.
Awesome.
Or at least see what I did with it. All right, then it is time for us to go and talk to Mike Shea from Sly Flourish. He's going to talk to us about a very apropos topic. He's going to give us some quick tips on running skill challenges.
Hi, Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com and Twitter.com/SlyFlourish. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about skill challenges. Specifically, I'm going to offer up three tips that might make skill challenges run a little bit better at your table. While Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition has a very refined system for handling combat, the system for handling skill challenges isn't nearly as well defined. There's a lot of room for interpretation, and there's a lot of different ways that skill challenges might actually run. The first tip I want to offer up is a question that often comes up with people designing skill challenges and people running them at the table, which is whether or not to tell your players that they're in a skill challenge or not. Generally speaking, I'm of the belief that you should not tell your players that they're in a skill challenge. I think you're better off describing the situation that they're in and running almost all of the mechanics behind the screen that you can. Your players should be focused on the kinds of things that they can do in the situation, not necessarily on what skill they should be using in order to get past the challenge. In particular, if you describe that you're in a skill challenge and you get too much into the mechanics, you'll find that your players are going to focus on using skills that they're trained in rather than using skills that make sense for the situation. So the more you can run a skill challenge behind the screen, the better off, the more your players are going to focus on the event and the less they're going to focus on the mechanics. The second tip I would like to offer up is to think about the design of the challenge, not in the mechanics, but in the actual situation. If you're going to sit down and come up with a situation, you want to spend time thinking about all of the details of that situation. For example, if you have the PCs hunting down a villain in a city, you're better off thinking about who that villain is, where they're hiding, who knows about it, what the guards know, what the merchants know, what the upper class knows, what the lower class knows. What are the things that, you know, what trail could they, that this person have possibly left? Your best bet is to think about that as a story. And think about all of the clues that could be around, not thinking about it from the terms of whether or not a player could be using streetwise or thievery or athletics or acrobatics, but think about the actual situation. The same is true for traps. If you have a really complicated trap and you want to kind of design a situation around it, a skill challenge around it, instead of thinking about what effects a player could use or a PC could use, instead think about how the trap is actually designed. Who built it? How does it work? How do they get around it when they need to get around it? Is it arcane? Is it mechanical? Is it both? If it's mechanical, exactly how do the mechanics work? And the more you can think about how the design of this thing actually works, the better it's going to run when you're telling your players about it. The third tip I'd like to offer is to not have combat as a failure for a skill challenge. That rather than saying, oh, well, you've managed to bypass fighting the orcs by sneaking around them when you're on your way to the castle. Instead, if you're anything like me, you kind of have your battles pre-planned out, and you don't want to spend the time to design a really interesting fight and then have players bypass it by doing a successful skill challenge. So instead, you might think about giving the players an advantage or a disadvantage when they head into that combat based on a skill challenge. So if they're chasing some orcs, some orc raiders through the woods, if they succeed in hunting down these orc raiders, they might get to drop on the orc raiders and gain a surprise round. If instead they fail at hunting down the orc raiders, maybe the orc raiders backtracked and found them, and now the orc raiders get a surprise round on the players. So that way you still have the same battle, only now, depending on how they did in the skill challenge, will determine whether or not the players have the advantage or the monsters have the advantage. So I hope that these three tips helped you think a little bit more about how you design skill challenges, and hopefully they'll make them run a little bit better at your table. Thank you very much.
All right, so now that we've heard from Mike and got some more tips on actually running skill challenges, which I don't think contradicted anything we had to say about running our specific skill challenge before, did it?
No, his last point's really important along those lines. You know, you'll notice that when we did ours, there's sort of a combat built in that's already pre-planned, whereas if we had a, you know, something in the middle like, oh, if you fail, then some of the monks attack you or the town guard comes after you or something, mm-hmm. that really can sort of throw things off and throw off the pacing especially.
Yeah. Now, we did have one scenario in our build where, you know, if everything went really, really well for you, you could avoid the combat altogether. I might be tempted as a DM to still reward the players as if they had won that combat.
Yep, I would completely do that.
So I might even have a situation where, okay, the party's got what they need and they're running out of town and, you know, the competition is standing at the gate shaking their fists at them knowing that there's no way to catch up now.
Yeah, or you can even sort of run it as a combat there at the end that, you know, you've managed to elude their grasp, but they still have a bunch of thugs that are coming after you, but you just need to get out of town onto your horses.
Yeah.
So you're sort of running a chase sort of thing on a battle map still, but getting them to let them use their powers a bit and cover people's escape and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And, I mean, you could also make it a situation, you know, however this goes in this whole skill challenge, I could totally see this competition still following their trail and popping up again when they do get to the fiery mountain with the orb of fire.
Oh, yes. Maybe even the PCs led them right to it.
Yes. I really like the idea of the PCs go in, they get the orb of fire, and then they're on their way out, and the competition is there saying, oh, thanks for getting that for us. Now hand it over.
Right. Not so fast.
Right. All right. So in any case, that's good advice there from Mike. Let's go ahead and hop to the other side of the screen then as we talk about skill challenges. I find that in order for skill challenges to go really well, it helps a lot when the players, I guess, know how to behave within a skill challenge. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And yeah. Even if they don't necessarily like it, it's like any other part of the game where if you're going to complain and try to derail it, it's going to ruin the fun for everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a couple of different approaches that I think a person can take as a player. And I think there's some that are I think they're all legitimate. I think there's different approaches that are have more appeal, I guess, depending on what kind of player you are. You know, my first note here is to talk about the mechanics approach versus the role playing approach. You know, and I think I think there are players for which the mechanics approach is appealing. Those are your min maxers who say, okay, I'm really good in this skill. You build your character to be really good in a different skill, so that our across the party we've covered most of the important skills with really good bonuses, so we all know who needs to do what, and we're all, you know, everybody make sure that you're assisting another whenever you can when these things are going on, and you take a very mechanical sort of approach to making sure that you roll the right numbers and defeat the challenge.
That kind of approach I tend to defeat.
Yeah. Right. Go ahead.
Yeah, if they're going to try to roll their best skill every time, they're going to have to work at it. You know, they're going to really have to explain how that skill is applicable.
Right. Yeah, and I tend to try to go the other way, too, because, I mean, ultimately, part of the point I think a lot of people have criticized the skill challenge mechanic as saying, well, great, now you don't have to role play anymore. You know, there's a mechanic to handle all of that for you. And I try to take the opposite approach, actually, of where the skill challenge enables better role playing.
Yeah, that's the approach I take too.
Right. You know, and so I try. You know, I take the approach, and I think Mike mentioned it in his segment as well. I don't announce a skill challenge anymore. I did it early on because it was one of the things advised back in DMG 1. And I've changed my approach where I don't announce we're in a skill challenge. I just say, here's the situation, and they do what they do, and I tell the narrative based off of how things go and how the roles go and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, for me, I generally don't. I would agree with that. There are still some situations where it's clear, especially if you've been in a fourth edition game for a while, or you know, if you're in the same campaign, you pretty much pick up on when skill challenges are happening.
Right.
There are still times, you know, depending on the scenario laid out, where it behooves you to say, well, if you don't get enough done on this, you know, if you fail too many times, then this consequence is going to happen that you can see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's fair. But I guess where I'm taking it is that in terms of as a player, I would rather have a player take the role-playing approach.
Definitely.
Don't worry so much about what skills you're good at, but worry more about what you would do in that situation, and the DM can then determine what skill you need to roll for that. You know, I had a brilliant situation in my session just this last weekend where the party was questioning an angel of prophecy. And they were trying to find out about the wizard who created the original airship, right? They were trying to find out about what was this wizard's prophecy so that, maybe that'll give us some information about what he was doing with the airship. And then at one point, the Warforged, who is always all about, you know, can I intimidate him? Can I intimidate him? Can I intimidate him? Because it's the only skill he's good at, asked the question, oh, well, what was the wizard's prophecy? Like, nobody at that point in had actually managed to ask that question just outright.
Mm-hmm.
And since he was the one to ask the question, I said, oh, that's a great question. You get to roll diplomacy. You know?
Right.
So not what he would have done mechanically, but he was the one asking the question. It made a lot of sense for him to make the roll. And I think that was brilliant for him too. You know, for that moment, he got out of the mechanics of can I intimidate? And he got into, well, I'm curious and I've never been known to back down when I had a question in the past. So he asked the question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that made for an interesting sort of role-playing encounter.
Yeah, there are situations like that where it's almost like your character is trying to fail a check and a skill challenge. In the Eberron game I'm in that my girlfriend runs, there was a situation where all of the characters, through convoluted means, decided to pretend to be pirates to this crime lord.
Mm-hmm.
And my Warforged fighter was the captain of this pirate crew and thus insisted on doing all the talking. And, you know, he has like a negative charisma, you know, no bluff to think of. And yet here he was putting on this persona. And so it was almost like, because my character would be a bad liar, but definitely would insist on being the pirate captain and doing all the talking, that he was intentionally moving towards failure.
Right. And some of that can be fun role playing regardless, you know. You're there and you're having a good time, and if it means you botch the skill challenge, then that's okay, because ultimately a well designed skill challenge isn't going to botch the adventure.
Yep.
Regardless of what happens. So my next bit of thought on terms of being a good player in a skill challenge is a similar thought in a lot of discussions I have about running a character and being a good player in a game, and that's sharing the spotlight. Give other people a chance to participate in the challenge as well.
Absolutely. Even if it's your key skill, make sure other people can chime in too.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of times I reward that as a DM, and I think that's something to keep in mind. Don't think that, you know, just because you're not the strong one in diplomacy or whatever, that you shouldn't pipe up. In those situations, feel free to say your piece. And as a DM, I reward that by saying, great, make a diplomacy check to aid the guy who's doing most of the talking, you know?
Right.
And I think there's other areas where sometimes it's even okay to let somebody who doesn't have the highest skill check in that area take the lead and make the roll, because that's their situation. You know, that's for role-playing reasons or for background reasons, that character, it would make sense is having that conversation. You know, maybe you're not the bard and the diplomat of the party, but your family is friends with this guy that you're talking to. It makes more sense for you to have that conversation than it does for the high diplomacy character.
Yep. And you're the one who's got to make the rolls, even though other people might be able to help.
Right. And I think it's okay to do that in terms of a good role-playing situation. You know, and again, I think a well-designed skill challenge is not going to punish you too harshly for that situation, right? I mean, a well-designed skill challenge is going to allow you to progress through the story regardless. I think a lot of the frustrations that people have sometimes as a player in a skill challenge is that for a long time, people didn't know how to design them well and didn't know how to run them well. And so you couldn't quite trust that it was well designed, you know, because maybe it wasn't, you know, there were a lot of bad skill challenges.
There are a lot of bad ones out there.
So I think, hopefully with the episodes I'm putting out this April, that will help mitigate that a little bit for you guys. You know, if you think that you've got some bad skill challenges out there, make sure you send your DM over here to hear some of this conversation. My last bit of advice for players is think creatively in your skill challenge.
Can I talk about my campaign here?
Absolutely.
Okay. So it was a skill challenge I ran, but my players totally thought out of the box, you know, nothing I ever could have expected, where they were on a dwarven pirate airship and there was a gigantic dragon that they had no hope of hitting or hurting, was chasing after them, was going to take them down. And I had sort of thought, okay, they'll be able to make some checks to organize the crew and some checks to fire the ballista to try to slow it down and, you know, some kind of basic stuff. And what they ended up doing was finding the anchor, attaching that to some barrels of rum, and firing that out of a ballista while the D.Va rode it in order to put him into range to wrap around the dragon to use one of his teleportation powers to get him away, and while one of the other party members scooped up the D.Va with a flying leap.
And in that situation, were there any skills being rolled?
There were skills being rolled, not for some things, but like when they were searching around in the hold for useful things, like there was a check there, and the hole being fired out of ballista, like there were checks for that.
Even catching the D.Va at the end, you know, would be a good athletics or acrobatics check.
And was there a pretty crucial one at that?
Yeah. That sounds awesome. And I think that's a good way to sort of emphasize exactly what we're talking about here in terms of don't just go with what you think is going to be best necessarily. You know, don't think, okay, what does the DM want us to do here? Think, what can I do here? And use your environment and use the situation and be creative. Because like David mentioned earlier, like I would completely agree, when my players do something creative, I will oftentimes reward it. Now, not always. Mm-hmm. You know, if you come up with something completely off the wall and it doesn't make any sense, you're right. Sometimes I might shoot you down. But I think it's a really good idea to think, you know, maybe I don't need to use my diplomacy to convince this guy that I'm, you know, an interesting fellow to follow around. Instead, maybe I wow him with my acts of strength when I, you know, do 1,000 push-ups, or maybe I wow him with my juggling act and that convinces him to hang around me for a little bit longer or whatever, you know? I think be creative and you know, kind of almost going a little bit in the opposite direction of focus on the role-playing, but not really. I mean, you're focusing on this is what something my character would do. He's an athletic person. He would try to play to his own strengths.
Yeah, so I agree. I think it's totally role-playing when, you know, a character has a crazy idea. And it's actually, you know, if you were looking at it from a mechanics perspective, when you're trying to think like a DM and like, oh, what skills are on a sheet there, you know, that's kind of the opposite of role-playing right there. But right. Creative ideas, totally in that box.
Absolutely. And so I think that's a fair way to go. It's not a matter of, you know, can I use my athletics check here, DM? Okay, that's a mechanical way of thinking. Instead, it's, hey, I want to use my athletics check to do this amazing feat of strength and wow the crowd or whatever. That's role-playing. And I think that's an important distinction to make. All right. So to summarize what we talked about today real quick, we built a skill challenge. We said that it's good to have a variety of different skills so that more people have an opportunity to participate. And don't hinge the story on any skill challenge, any one skill. Make it, if there's failure, don't make it fail the story. Make it turn into a complication. Does that cover some of the basic advice we had in building the skill challenge?
Yep, I agree with all those completely.
Okay, and then our tips for playing in a skill challenge were try to focus on the role-playing, share the spotlight, and think creatively when you're coming up with what your character would do.
Mm-hmm.
I fear that we may have reached the end of the episode. Don't be sad. It's okay.
I just can't contain my sadness.
There'll be another one. But in any case, this has been episode 131. I want to thank our sponsor for the episode, FRPGames.com, and our guest for the episode, Dave Chalker from Critical-Hits.com.
Thanks for having me on again.
Anywhere else people should go to find you? Or everything you do is on Critical Hits?
Pretty much everything I do is on Critical Hits. I will plug specifically that if you want more information about skill challenges, we run a pretty massive guide that's got advice, just links to other sites who've talked about it. And this episode will certainly go on that list as well. Just example skill challenges, how to run a skill challenges, critique, that kind of thing.
Awesome. Well, and if you have a thought about skill challenges that you want to share, you can always email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums at vorpalnetwork.com, which I have been pimping heavily in the last several episodes because they're new and they're up and they're still fairly small, which sometimes is better, in my opinion. If you have a kind of a smaller community, it's easier to keep up with what's going on in the conversations. But I like to see some growth and I like to see some activity over there, so head on over and say hello. Tell us what you think about skill challenges. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show, including Critical Hits, FRP Games, and more, can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. Well, we've snuck past the guard, followed the trail to the lizard people through the Swamp of Disenchantment, and removed the power from the almighty spider creature of ultimate awesomeness in episode 131, Skill Challenge Advice of...
I'm on the wall.